You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Film Spotting is presented by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week, as we ponder whether the world really needed to see Spider-Man back on the big screen, we'll offer up our favorite good films that very easily could have been, and probably should have been, terrible. It's our top five seemed like a bad idea at the time movies.
It's safe to say Massacre Theater is always a bad idea at the time, no?
Pretty much.
Yeah, I think so. Even so, we'll still play it later on in the show. Also, we'll spend time dissecting Entertainment Weekly's recent list of 50 great movies you've never seen.
But first, spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out. Here comes the Spider-Man.
This life is not an easy one. I've made enemies. Powerful enemies. I've put those I love in danger. But the one thing that has haunted me my entire life is finding the truth about my parents.
I'm not going to start with a too soon question that everyone's been asking in regards to The Amazing Spider-Man. Yes, it's only been 5 years since Spider-Man 3. Yes, new director Mark Webb and new stars Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone essentially retell the origin story that Sam Raimi, Tobey Maguire, and Kirsten Dunst told in 2002. At the end of the day, who cares as long as this Spider-Man movie is compelling in a new and invigorating way? Personally, it would take a lot for me to tire of Spider-Man. When it came to superhero obsessions as a kid, this was my Halloween costume. These were my underoos. I can vividly recall ill-advised attempts to climb the walls of my dad's study. Why that room, I don't know. The bottom line is I'd be fine with a Spider-Man movie every 6 months if, and this is a big if, the filmmakers convinced me that something motivated them to make the picture beyond the fact that they were hired. Adam, fine-tune your spider sense and tell me. What driving force did you detect behind The Amazing Spider-Man? An artistic vision or corporate decisions?
Well, unfortunately, I'd have to lean corporate decisions for sure. We certainly know the studio has one motivation here, and there is something a little clinical about the whole thing. But I do think it'd be unfair to decry Mark Webb and Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone or any of the performers for not having artistic intentions and ambitions. I didn't get the sense anybody was phoning it in here at all. Not only do we have two very good leads, but Dennis Leary, Sally Field, Martin Sheen, they're all working very hard with often limited material. But, of course, genuinely loving the material isn't always enough, and having good intentions isn't always enough. And the key problem with The Amazing Spider-Man does get back to your key question and this notion of whether or not there's something invigorating about it. I think the problem is that, stylistically, Mark Webb seems to be just combining Sam Raimi's palette with the occasional Christopher Nolan artsy camera angle. And narratively, he's pretty much just hitting all of the same thematic beats that Raimi already covered, just with a few tweaks. I mean, other than overall being more serious, there are a lot more characters deeply emoting than I remember in the 2002 version. And Garfield comes off as more brooding than Tobey Maguire did, as I remember him. it is the same story about how with great power comes great responsibility, and I didn't see what was driving the burning desire to retell this tale.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction to make. I'm glad you brought that up. I didn't find that anyone was phoning it in either. So that's not the problem here. Yet at the same time, although maybe I'll back up and say I think Emma Stone looked pretty bored in a couple of these scenes. But at the same time, I don't feel that Mark Webb had any real vision behind it, why he wanted to make this story and what he was going to bring to it. I think that's what you're getting at. And that was my problem with it as well. And then that filters down to the performances. There's not something that they're going to pick up on and carry through. So it very much felt like an assignment, competently done in a lot of ways.
Right.
There were some good things about it that I liked. I mean, this is not a disaster, but again, I expect something new, a new direction, a new tone, new aura, something. A good model is, and it may be unfair to compare it to what Nolan did with the Batman franchise, but I think that is a good model when you look at reboots, how distinct that is from the Burton films. And again, I don't need this to be darker or to be kind of the Dark Knight version, just something a little distinct, something that has a reason for being besides the fact that Columbia needed a superhero movie on its 2012 release slate. That's just the defining feel I got from this.
I agree. And I think that Keith Phipps, our friend from the AV Club, said it well. I'm sure others have used a similar phrase. This really is more of a reset than a reboot. Unfortunately, they really are just taking that story and resetting it. They're not even really updating it. It seems to take place pretty much in the exact same universe. Of course it does. It was just 10 years ago, and more recently with Spider-Man 3, 5 years ago, as the Raimi films. That all said, I've told you how my son Holden, who's 10, feels about superheroes. You know that he's into Harry Potter and The Hunger Games and Percy Jackson. He's into actual mythology, not the mythology of guys who wear capes or, in this case, spandex. And I remember about 6 months ago, I know I shared this with you and maybe even on air as well, we were watching some other film and they played a preview for The Amazing Spider-Man, the first one that I had seen. And I actually thought it looked pretty good. I got kind of excited about it. And I turned to him and said, what do you think? And he pretty much just shrugged his shoulders. Really, he
shattered
could not,
his dad's dreams.
No, it could have been a Merchant Ivory production. He had absolutely no interest. So I dragged him to Spider-Man with me and I pretty much had to just sell him on the fact that there'd be a lot of science in it.
Of okay.
course, Peter Parker being a scientist, and you knew that there was the whole Reese Ifans angle. So you can count on that from Spider-Man. He was intrigued. And I'm just going to say, my 10-year-old loved this film. He
sure.
can't wait to get it on DVD. He right away asked me if this was the first Spider-Man movie or were there others he could watch. And he's really disappointed that it'll take a couple of years for the next ones to come out. But I told him, of course, there is this backlog of films we can watch. So I'm saying all this just to note that maybe on some level, Webb did succeed in introducing Spider-Man to a new generation of fans.
But that's a mercenary goal. That's not an artistic goal. That's
yeah.
one that Columbia had in mind, not
I agree.
Necessarily that the director should have in
Ultimately,
mind.
Ultimately, I agree. And I think the thing is, I feel like if I had just been a better father and sat down and watched Raimi's first version with him, he would have already loved Spider-Man to begin with, and he would have seen Webb's version and thought it was just as redundant as I did.
Maybe. I also think, you know, what 10-year-old boy is not going to like a Spider-Man movie. It's probably rare. So to
probably.
To I completely understand why he would like it.
I'm not using to say the movie works, ultimately. It did
right.
not for me.
That's, I guess that's what I'm saying, is that it would have to be a disastrous movie for a 10-year-old boy to come to this thing and be like, boy, why did you drag me there? So it has those basic elements that it needs. That's why it's not a terrible movie. But again, going back to the terms that we kind of set, is what are you going to show me? Why are you here? Okay, really surprise me with why you're here. It doesn't do that. I've seen a lot of people kind of glom onto the performances, desperately looking. Some of the positive reviews, you can feel them desperately searching for a reason to say, yeah, we do need this movie. And kind of a recurring theme has been the performances. I've got to say, I was very disappointed by them because I thought this was at least an interesting cast. And we'll start with Andrew Garfield. I don't know what happened to him. Very talented actor. Maybe it was the pressure of this sort of franchise being on his shoulders, but I found him to be a very jumpy distraction in this film. It was kind of weird, and maybe this is how he chose to play the character, and I was misreading it, but he would often repeat his lines as if he was trying to grasp onto them, trying to find the character in the dialogue.
Almost this Brando-esque thing.
Something like that is
yeah.
going on, but I found it distracting, and mostly he just lets his moist eyes do the emotional work. I mean, Webb's probably to fault a little bit for relying on that too much, But the amount of scenes where we just see Andrew Garfield kind of getting moist in the eyes, and that's supposed to let us understand of what an emotional kid he is.
Right.
That didn't work for me at all. And I'd be interested to hear not only what you thought of Garfield, but the chemistry with Emma Stone. And the chemistry thing is often, you know, it's hard to pin down. It's going to be different for everyone else. It just really jumped out to me. I know that Stone is Garfield's junior in age, but her Gwen Stacy seems way ahead of his Peter Parker in terms of maturity and
right.
intelligence. They kind of play that up a little bit in that she's supposed to be responsible. But for me, it translated into she was almost like the guidance counselor in high school, and he was the incoming freshman. And that just didn't work for me when it came to a romance.
Did you get expelled?
No, I didn't get expelled. I got community service. You want to, I don't know.
Want what?
I don't know. Just, I don't know. We could do something else, or we could, if you don't, I mean, we could.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, either one.
Really?
Sure.
Okay. All right, good. Sounds good.
You're listening to Film Spotting, Adam and Josh talking about the reset, not really a reboot, of the Spider-Man franchise. It's Mark Webb's The Amazing Spider-Man, and we agree ultimately on the film, it seems like, but we are going to disagree a little bit on the performances. I do think Garfield pushes his goofiness a little bit too far. Maybe it's something where he is a 28-year-old playing a high school kid, and so they make the hair a little shaggy and kind of put the bangs in his eyes, and he kind of shrugs his shoulders a little bit and tries to act awkward, and you see moments where he's acting awkward. That said, when he's with Emma Stone, even though you're absolutely right in pinpointing that she seems way more mature than him, but then again, that's often the case with girls in high school, probably, I like them together. That is a strength of this film for me. I love how serious they took those romantic scenes and how invested they seemed in them. So that actually worked for me. And I think maybe overall I'm a little bit more favorable on this film than you are, even as much as I do think it's redundant and a lot of it didn't work. The fact is, not only did those two central performances have enough to keep me interested, I did enjoy watching Martin Sheen and Sally Fields as Aunt May and Uncle Ben. And I really like how much time Mark Webb and the screenwriters take in setting up the story before getting to the direct conflict and the plot really kicks in. Even if I was way too familiar with it, I like the fact that they treated it as if it had never been done before. That worked for me. And I also liked how much time it took in all of the action scenes. I think Webb, with his camera, was much more interested in Spidey and his movement than dazzling us with destruction, which you've already seen from other superhero movies this summer that I won't mention. I felt like you really had a sense of where Spider-Man was, where he was in relation to the bad guy or whatever the scene was in terms of its larger context. I really liked how it didn't have that sort of standard MTV action movie hyper editing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the benefits of the Spider-Man story is it is focused on this one guy and his athletic abilities, mm-hmm. and it's so tailor-made for the cinema. I wasn't quite as wild about the first-person point of view that the movie often gives him. It made it feel a little video game-ish to me. But there is one really great rescue sequence that I'd put alongside anything in Raimi's films, actually. The sequence of the car hanging from the bridge.
It's really good.
That the little boy is in. And I liked the touch that's given to it where Spider-Man convinces the little boy to climb out of his seat toward safety, which seems like a scary thing for the kid, by giving him his mask. I really like that touch. He says to him, you know, it'll make you strong. I thought that was a really human moment. And I'll give Webb credit for this. He also brings some human moments to Rhys Ifans' role as the villain, this genetic scientist who it's, you know, science experiment gone wrong, standard story. He begins turning into a giant lizard. I don't know if you've specifically seen that before, but I like how much attention is given, how many pauses there are. He happens to have one arm, the scientist, and it's part of his motivation for repairing his own body. And there's just a shot where Ethan's standing by this window and his reflection happens to make it look like his body is whole. And he pauses and looks at it longingly. I like that little shot. I don't know if that's something you can credit Webb for, is saying that here's a somewhat indie director coming from 500 Days of Summer is more of a emotional type romance, is going to allow for those moments in a big budget spectacle. It's still not justifying why the movie had to be made or why he had to make it.
No, it's not. And unfortunately, good moments like that are having to cover up moments like when he meets his new crop of interns. He has to explain to them that he's the world's foremost authority on X subject. If you're the world's foremost authority on a subject, you have to introduce yourself to them in that way.
It's on his business card, actually.
It is on his business card. And the fact is they're coming to work for that corporation, probably largely because of him. So that's a goofy moment. And I felt like in general, this whole notion that Kirk Connors, that character, has of he wants a world without weakness. There's something about that that's just so obviously sinister. You know, there's nothing really altruistic about trying to help people who are weak. It automatically suggests this idea of superiority, which I'm guessing that was by design. They're trying to build that into the character.
Yeah.
But then we know he's going to turn when he does have an opportunity to turn and become a bad guy. If he's looking for a world without weakness, well, he's going to embrace this almost Nietzschean superhero side. So it just telegraphs that. And there are a lot of little moments like that that don't work.
There are. And I think the word for him is juvenile. I don't remember Raimi's films being, although they're set in high school and Tobey Maguire is supposed to be, they're jokey and he's supposed to be dorky. I don't remember them being this juvenile. I would describe the romance here is giggly. It worked for you. It didn't work for me because it was giggly. There are so many repeated obvious gags about his super strength that they just keep coming and coming, and we get it. I found that juvenile.
Right.
There's a school bully who has to be the most cartoonish school bully I've seen in quite some
time.
Doesn't
really seem like he's material for an all-science high school.
No, that's a good point.
A science high school has the jocks who beat up
the nerds. Yeah, because they have the basketball team.
Right.
Which brings me to probably the silliest moment is when Garfield takes the basketball and to kind of show up the bully does this flying, I guess it's a Spider-Man-ish dunk from half court that really makes no sense and reminded me of Twilight's infamous vampire baseball scene.
See, fortunately, I have no idea what you're referring to.
Oh, you've got to see the vampire baseball scene. It's well worth it.
I'm not sure I want to.
So it's this sort of silliness. It made me wonder, is maybe they're going for like a tween market here. Is actually when I was trying to figure out what's the strategy behind this? What's the guiding force behind this movie? Not only from Columbia, but Webb as well. Are they trying to go for some sort of juvenile tween approach, playing up the giggly romance, having this sort of silliness throughout? And I don't know. Perhaps that's it.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. We're spending just another minute or two on The Amazing Spider-Man. And I think you're right with the use of the word juvenile. One of the other things that bothered me was this juxtaposition of really corny, jokey moments with the seriousness, the heft of the story, the melodrama of the story, if you will, which was a nice counter in some ways to what we got from Raimi. But unfortunately, then you get to moments where he's really outmanned here fighting this lizard. He is in genuine danger, and I would have liked for them to embrace that genuine sense of danger. Instead, they're always undercutting it by having him make some smart-aleck joke that isn't even that funny to begin with.
Yeah, and I've established I'm not the comic book expert by any means, but I'm wondering if that is true to the character. We'll have to appeal to our panel, Film Spotting panel of comic book experts, and see what they say, because I seem to have this feeling that Peter Parker is supposed to be kind of a smart aleck.
Sure.
And that's part of the, you know, the cartoon series was my familiarity as a kid.
Right.
So I wasn't really into the comic books. I'm not quite sure, but I have this sense he was supposed to be jokey and maybe they were going for that. But you're exactly right. Stuff like the crotch shot, the web he shoots to the villain's crotch. He's like some sort of thug or a car thief or something.
Right.
I mean, that just felt a little juvenile too. I don't know if they were going for the traditional Spider-Man character there or what, but it didn't really work for me.
Since I am, though, the authority here on Film Spotting on trying to recognize movie homages, did you notice some of the references I felt like Webb was going for? Whether positive or negative, you've obviously got direct references or mentions of Godzilla and King Kong at the end of the film with the villain climbing up the tall building. But did you also notice the shot near the end of the film, without giving anything away, of Andrew Garfield with his hood on, walking down the grimy streets of New York City that looked like the poster from Taxi Driver or one of the posters I've seen? It's a direct shot. It has to be from Scorsese. And earlier in the film, what happens when he finally has a great day? He talks to Gwen, the girl he obviously has a thing for. She's showing him a lot of attention. They're going to go out on a date later, but he says he has to go first. And what does he do? Where does he go? He goes off to that shipyard or whatever. It's a total ripoff of Footloose. It's his Footloose moment, just like Kevin Bacon.
And that is a perfect way to describe it, because it's also silly like that. He spends, when he first discovers his powers, he spends it in this shipyard riding his skateboard really high. That's how he uses his spider powers. I you know, even the little kid in me thought that was kind of lame.
All right. Well, The Amazing Spider-Man is out now in theaters everywhere. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail 206-203-2463 or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
What are the greatest of the 50 great films you've never seen? Adam and I consider Entertainment Weekly's list next. Stay with us.
Your family and friends will never die. Everybody's gonna be all right tonight.
Take a moment to share our Audible recommendations for this week. Very excited to have Audible back on board for a few months here on Film Spotting and hopefully beyond. Audible.com is the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment.
Audible provides digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod. Listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you're listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from. Every genre, Audible has it covered.
You know, and as we note every week here on the show, we are largely listener-supported here on Film Spotting, but every bit helps, and having Audible as a sponsor really does help keep us doing what we're doing. And we love the fact that we know it's working because you send us in these great picks, and you are going to audible.com, and you're checking out some of these recommendations, and that keeps Audible coming back to Film Spotting. We got a great pick here from Jay in Stanford. The book is 1Q84 by Haruki Murakami. He says, I was introduced to Murakami by a high school English teacher and was completely transfixed. Though not, in my opinion, his greatest work, 1Q84 works perfectly in audio form. The novel has three narrators who alternate chapters, and in the audio version, each is read by a different actor. It's fairly long, but like all Murakami, it's impossible to put down.
Another recommendation came via Facebook. It's from TG, Perks of Being a Wallflower. Listen to it before the movie, directed by author Stephen Chbosky, comes out this fall. Also, I'm loving The Chaperone, about a 15-year-old Louise Brooks making her first journey to New York City at 15.
We look forward to getting more of your Audible.com recommendations. Go to Facebook.com/filmspotting, share them there on our wall, or you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net, and we just might feature them here on the show.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
Your family and friends will never die. Everybody's gonna be all right tonight. Your family and friends will never die.
Excellent. Well done. Very good. Very good.
So where is everyone? We had 100 on the guest list.
You were the Sex Pistols gig. How many people were in the audience?
It was about 40.
Right. And it was history.
Yeah, but there's only 30 here tonight.
Exactly, exactly. The smaller the attendance, the bigger the history. There were 12 people at the Last Supper, half a dozen at Kitty Hawk. Archimedes was on his own in the bath.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. A scene there from Michael Winterbottom's great film, 24-Hour Party People. We're going to spend a little bit of time on that movie and other films that came up on Entertainment Weekly's recent list of the 50 great movies you've probably never seen a little bit later in this segment. But first, it's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a screenplay and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, we massacred this scene.
You know something? It hurt. It hurt like a son of a bitch. It even bled. And why is that, John?
You're turning human.
What?
More time you spend in that body, the more human you become.
You mean I have to live out the rest of my life in this body? No f***ing way! You got me into this, you get me out!
I can't do that, Chucky.
Why not?
Because you're an abomination. An outrage against nature! You perverted everything I've taught you and used it for evil, and you have to be stopped.
That's Raymond Oliver as Dr. Death, and the voice of Brad Dorff as Chucky in 1988's Child's Play, directed by Tom Holland, who also made 1985's horror classic Fright Night.
Wow, screenplay, he was on a roll, huh?
Yeah, screenplay by Holland, Don Mancini, and John Lafia. David from Brooklyn explains it ties into our review of Ted last week, another case of a child's toy being brought to life, though chances are Ted will be less likely to make a generation of children unable to sleep for weeks afterwards.
It turns out we actually scarred another listener,
yeah,
too.
We struck a nerve there.
We did. Here is what Reed Volk from Aptos, California had to say. Wow. When I was young, I watched Child's Play at a friend's house. It absolutely traumatized me. I mean, sleep on the floor of my parents' bedroom for a month traumatized. Ever since, I have been actively repressing memories of that film. Fast forward to today. I was out on an innocent jog and thoroughly enjoying a lighthearted and insightful review of Ted. Then, seemingly out of nowhere, you tore open the floodgates and all of the pain that I had worked so hard to suppress came rushing back into my brain. Needless to say, I am on my way to get psychiatric care. I'll fax you guys the bill.
It sounds a lot like what happens whenever I might be flipping channels late at night, and occasionally, once a year or so, The Exorcist will be on, and I'll get a shot.
Oh, that does it for you, huh?
I'll get a shot of Linda Blair's face, and it sends me wanting to run up to my parents' bedroom.
Yeah.
Just like I was when I was 7 or 8, you know? I mean, I have the same childlike
reaction. The Shining does it for me.
I can see that.
Yep.
Dan Jackson here in Chicago wrote in and said, kudos to Josh for the Chucky impression. I've never actually seen the movie, but I'm assuming Adam was going for a Jamaican accent. He kind of slipped into a Schwarzenegger voice a few times, and we certainly heard that from a lot of listeners. I don't know. I think maybe I blacked out at some point. I was so in character. One listener actually just wrote in and said it sounded like Schwarzenegger with a concussion.
Is that what you were going for, Schwarzenegger?
No.
Because he did spend time in Haiti with a voodoo witch doctor. Yeah, it was after he was in Austria, bodybuilder,
mm-hmm.
Haiti, then Hollywood.
All right.
So you were accurate.
I was on the right track. Well, reach into the not-so-brimming film spotting hat, Josh. We have some people that need to catch up with 1988's Child's Play, apparently, and pick out a winner.
Our winner is a local guy, John Greif from Chicago.
Congratulations, John. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with your prize.
Oh, yeah. Makes perfect sense, Nick. I just, you know, I haven't found it yet. I'll get it, though.
Hey, what about you, Chuck?
I'm there, man. I'm there. I got the dam bursting, the river, everything. You watch. Changing the block is really going to open things up for me.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent, foreign, and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Support Film Spotting and sign up now at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
And this week's Massacre Theater winner will get a complimentary 6-month subscription to Fandor. Josh, we're not going to give anybody any hints with this scene. We will note that there isn't a direct connection to any of the films we're talking about on this week's show,
no.
As far as we know.
No Spider-Man connection.
Listeners may find something, but right, no clear top five connection, no Spider-Man connection. So we'll see if people can catch on to what we're going for here. There's one key name reference here at the beginning of the scene that we did alter to not make it painfully obvious, but we'll see how many people are familiar with this film. Josh, are you ready?
Yep.
I'm going to give you the action. And action.
I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to move that way and fast. Now let's go.
Mr. Rollo. Mr. Rollo.
What's the matter? What happened? Where you been?
With Mr. Scott. We found a hatch. We thought it might lead to the engine room, but he wasn't sure. So he told me, if he wasn't back in 5 minutes, to tell you to do it your way.
Dude, that does it. We've been wasting time sitting here while we should have been up front with those other people. Now come on, let's go.
And scene. Whew, I'm glad you made it through that.
I did. It was hard. I'm hyperventilating now. I think you were channeling Quint from Jaws there a little bit.
I think it was a
one-trick pony.
It was a Quint Chucky combo.
Yes, it was.
I'm stuck in a rut.
It was. We need to give you the female part next time. If you know what film we massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is July 17th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
The fact is, I'm in love with somebody else.
You are?
At least I think I am. It's not the right time to talk about it.
No, go on. Would I know his name, this guy?
You'll think I'm a stupid little girl with a crush.
Trust me.
Well, we've already mentioned Sam Raimi's name enough times in this show. We might as well play a scene from his Spider-Man 2002, the original Spider-Man and love interest, if you will. Kirsten Dunst there is MJ with Tobey Maguire's Peter Parker. And this sets up nicely our poll question from last week. We were looking ahead to the fact that we were probably going to discuss The Amazing Spider-Man, and we wanted to know how interested you were in this reboot, reset, whatever you want to call it, of the Spider-Man franchise. Hopefully, these results aren't going to make us feel really bad about talking about the movie for as long as we did, Josh. Your options were, it's too soon, I'm skipping it. It's too soon, but I can't resist Spidey. It's too soon, but I can't resist Stone and Garfield. Or, what do you mean too soon? I'm 11. How did it come out?
We don't have a lot of 11-year-olds in our listening audience,
I guess,
apparently.
Not.
Now, only 7% for that. Too soon, but I can't resist Spidey came in with 23%.
And that's where we both voted.
Yeah, exactly. Spidey was the draw for us. Too soon, but I can't resist Stone and Garfield actually had 29%. But too soon, I'm skipping it. 41%.
Ouch. 40% of our audience just decided
don't
to
care.
Tune out. Just did not care at all. Well, we apologize. Hopefully you still found something of interest there in that discussion. Thanks to everyone who voted. We hope you'll go to filmspotting.net and vote in this week's question, though. If you're just not a fan of superhero movies, of comic book franchises, well,
it's a bad time of year for you, first of all.
It's going to feel redundant for you, and you're right. It's going to be a bad summer all around. But we're looking forward to Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight Rises opens next weekend here. We're going to discuss it on next weekend's show. So we've got a Batman death match here for you. These are always tough, but they're always fun. Josh, their options are
Burton's Batman or Nolan's Batman Begins.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot.
So we're not doing the whole franchises
nope.
here. We're just doing these
first
two films. Okay. That actually makes it easier for me, and I'll go with Burton's Batman then.
Because if you're considering the whole franchise, you probably have to go just on the strength of Batman Begins and The Dark Knight.
Yep.
You have to go with those over the sequels.
That's how I was.
Original.
That's how I was kind of thinking about it otherwise. But if you put these two against each other, I'm comfortable with going with Burton's Batman.
I think I'd go that way as well, but I have to admit that maybe that's just my nostalgic reaction to that Batman film and the fact that I was 14 when it came out. It was such a big deal at the time. Who knows? We want to know what you think, though. Vote now at filmspotting.net.
Gertie, have you heard anything new about anyone fixing Lunar Sat?
No, Sam. What I understand is it's fairly low on the company's priority list right now.
Tell them to sort that out. You know what I'm talking about? That's not... I've only got 2 weeks, but it's not fair to whoever's coming up here next.
I will, Sam. Do you want me to finish cutting your hair later?
Nah, come on, let's finish this.
That's a scene from Duncan Jones' debut film, Moon, starring Sam Rockwell, the inaugural Golden Brick winner here on Film Spotting. If you're a regular listener of the show, you know that every year we try to highlight movies that were probably overlooked, maybe not as mainstream, that we think need to get a little more attention, a little more love. And Moon, as we said, was our first winner. And it's also a film that came up on a recent list that Entertainment Weekly did of 50 great movies you've never seen. But they just went back to 1991. Basically, over the past two decades, here are 50 films that had some different experts and celebrities weigh in with their picks as well. And they gave you 50 movies that basically would be golden bricks for them, 50 films that they think are overlooked. And we actually got a note from a listener, Josh Tom, in Piedmont, California, who said he got home to find Entertainment Weekly's list and saw a lot of Film Spotting recommendations in the bunch. He'd seen five of the 50, mostly thanks to Film Spotting recommendations over the years. So we thought it might be fun to look at this list briefly. If you want to see the entire list of 50 films, we're not going to mention all of them. We'll put a link to it in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net. But we did think it might be interesting to share a couple personal picks from their list, as well as some that we're ashamed to admit we've never seen. But we wanted to start with the top five, a little bonus top five, if you will. Here are the Film Spotting endorsed top five films from this list, basically the five Film Spotting movies that have been talked about a lot over the years, whether they've been discussed in detail or maybe they've appeared on a lot of top fives. Here are the five movies from this list that come up a lot on the show.
Number five is Together, 2000 film from Sweden. Number four would be Moon, which you mentioned. Number three, Wendy and Lucy, early Kelly Reichardt film. That's I really, really like that one. Number two, 24-Hour Party People. We heard from a little earlier in the show, Michael Winterbottom, of course. And this one, the number one film, I'm kind of surprised it was even on this list because I do hear about it a lot, The Iron Giant, If anyone hasn't seen that yet, yeah, they definitely need to get a hold of that.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's at number one. Not only was it discussed during an animation marathon here on Film Spotting many years ago, but it's also come up in a few top fives over the years. Just a fantastic film from Brad Bird. So those are the Film Spotting top five official picks, if you will. Josh, what about a couple personal recommendations from this Entertainment Weekly list? A couple of movies that stood out for you that you agree really do need to get more attention?
Yeah, one of these may be familiar too, and the other one probably very few people have heard of, but I'll start with a familiar one. That's Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. Really, really interesting Jim Jarmusch film with Forrest Whitaker about tribalism in a lot of ways and just mixes a lot of elements into it. And that's well worth checking out. Very different for Jarmusch too. So it's not necessarily representative of him, would you say? But it's just a really fascinating film.
Yeah, it has very similar stylistic traits in many ways to some of his other films, that kind of deadpan style. But
yeah, there's
deadpan
stuff in it. Yeah, it's just such a wonderful mix.
The subject matter seems eclectic even for him.
Exactly, yeah. My other pick would be Murderball, which is a 2005 documentary about paraplegic rugby players. And this was just really outstanding in the way it allowed its figures to have their full humanity. It didn't focus on their situations. It kind of focused on their personalities, and their situations was a side part of that, which allowed them to be really full people. Great doc, worth checking out.
Well, that's one that I'd have to add to my shame list. I have not actually caught up with Murderball, but I'll give you another documentary that is one of my personal picks, and it's Marwan Call, just from a year or two ago. Really fascinating documentary about a man who was beat up in a bar fight, basically. He was attacked, and it left him with some permanent damage, and one of the interesting side effects, for lack of a better way to describe it, is he creates this world. He basically creates his life in this miniature world of this place called Marwan Call, and there's military action going on, and he's one of the figures that he's designed for this world, and he meets women and other men that he fights against, and it's just really fascinating to see this world that this character has constructed. So that's one I definitely recommend. And another one that has come up on Film Spotting over the years and was reviewed here is El Orfanato, The Orphanage. This is really creepy thriller directed by a young filmmaker named Juan Antonio Bayona. And it occurred to me as I was thinking about The Orphanage, what has this guy done since 2007 when this movie came out? He's got another film coming out. It's called The Impossible that looks like it's slated for a 2012 release, and it stars Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor. So right there seems like a good cast to have on board. But after The Orphanage, I'll definitely see whatever this guy does.
We were talking earlier about films that still haunt us to this day. You mentioned Exorcist. I mentioned Shining. I think The Orphanage is the last movie that startled me awake at night with images. I was sound asleep, woke up thinking about The Orphanage,
right,
and could not get back to sleep.
I can absolutely see that. It's a really good film. So there are a lot more great films on this list, including some films that we haven't actually seen and need to see. So, Josh, which one or two stood out for you as films that you're the most embarrassed about?
There are a couple here that are early efforts from filmmakers I've really come to admire that I never caught up with. So it's extra shameful because I really like what they've done lately. One of these would be Nicole Holofcener's debut, Walking and Talking, from 1996. Somehow have never seen that one. And every time she has a new film out, I know I got to catch up with that because I really appreciate her unique film style. The other one is Chuck and Buck from 2000.
Good movie.
Has Cedar
Mike
Rapids
White.
Director Miguel Arteta. Has Year of the Dog writer-director Mike White. I really liked Year of the Dog.
Oh,
you
man.
Know very well how much I like Cedar Rapids. So how have I not seen Chuck and Buck? Plus, it was a huge sensation. That's one that's kind of surprising to find on this list because there was so much talk about it when it did come out.
Year of the Dog makes Chuck and Buck look like Annie Hall.
Wow.
By comparison.
You don't like Year of the Dog.
No,
huh?
But I don't like Year of the Dog, so that's really pretty meaningless. Chuck and Buck is a good movie. I hope you get a chance to see it. We can talk about it at some point on the show. For me, the two films that stood out the most were Enter the Void, the Gaspar Noé film. This is a filmmaker who I still don't think I've seen any of his films, and it has to do largely with the fact that every time we talk about one-timers on this show or disturbing movies, disturbing films that you see once and you appreciate them, you may even love them, but you don't really ever need to see again because they do haunt you, whether they're meant to be scary or not, you can't let them go. His film Irreversible comes up again and again, and I can't get myself to be excited to sit down and watch it. I couldn't bring myself to see Enter the Void either. So that's one that really stands out. That's a 2009 film. I'm going to have to break down and man up at some point and watch one of his movies. And the other one is a 2002 film called Lilja Forever. This is another film from the director of Together, Lucas Moodysson, the Swedish director.
Yeah.
He's got two on this list. And it's a movie that just sounds really interesting and was also featured on a few lists I saw back when we were looking at the top films of the decade. There were some critics that had it in their top 10, 15, 20, and I felt pretty bad that I hadn't seen it yet. So those two, for me, were the ones that really stood out. But there are, again, some really good movies on this list. If you haven't seen, they are overlooked. Fish Tank is on there, George Washington, David Gordon Green's first movie.
You might not want to watch George Washington. They'll just make you extra sad about what's happened to his career lately.
Unfortunately, maybe so. Rescue Dawn, the Werner Herzog film, was on the list. And Primer, that's a movie from Shane Carruth, the time travel movie. I also heartily recommend if you get a chance to see it. So, again, some good stuff from that Entertainment Weekly list. We're curious for your thoughts on the list. What movies stood out for you as ones that you really regret you haven't seen yet? Which ones are your personal recommendations, the ones that top your list? Again, we'll link to the full list in our notes at filmspotting.net, and you can email us your picks at feedback@filmspotting.net.
Sometimes a bad movie idea is just a bad movie idea. Remember Disney's The Country Bears?
I don't, actually.
Well, there you have it. Lilja Forever, The Country Bears, double feature. Sometimes, though, bad ideas do result in cinema excellence. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
David used to be creative, seeing screens in all our faces, talking like a kid Scorsese, making films of kids in pain. Summer would always come around, we talk about our dreams, we talk about the way they're running, gives a respite from depression. But I'm not saying that I'm the man.
We want to take a moment to thank all of our very generous Film Spotting supporters, people who've donated some of their hard-earned dollars over the past week or so. But first, we do have a few plugs. We want to mention Jeff Goldsmith's great podcast, The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, if you like hearing great interviews with screenwriters, and also his new digital magazine, Backstory, of course, has launched for the iPad. You can find both of those by doing a search in iTunes. Also, a quick note, Josh, we just got this today, and it sounds pretty interesting. A local documentary team mentioned this documentary called The Atom Smashers that actually aired in 2008 on Independent Lens on PBS, and it's a movie that basically explains what all the hubbub is about with the Higgs boson discovery.
That would be helpful.
It would be helpful, and according to their press materials, this movie clearly explains the science behind the discovery, and they're having a screening of it this Monday night, July 16th, at the Landmark here in Chicago. So for our local Chicago listeners listening to this podcast, if you're interested in this documentary, we'll have more information about it and how to get tickets in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net. Again, that's Monday, July 16th at 6:30 at the Landmark Century Theater. Also did want to mention our music this week, a band called Young Jesus. This came from a listener named David Driscoll in Washington, D.C., who recently took a trip back to Chicago, and he was able to see a few shows, and one of the bands he really liked was this group, he says, that is getting a lot of buzz, this young up-and-coming Chicago band called Young Jesus, and I checked it out. I like what I heard, and we love it when our listeners send us great music recommendations. We can't guarantee we're always going to play the music you send us or the music that your band plays, but please do send it to us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You never know. With that, let's get to our donations. We have a few thank yous and a few shout-outs this week, Josh. I love it when people kind of use us like Casey Kasem to get their messages out there. That's a reference none of the kids listening are going to get.
No, I don't think so.
It's too old. I already dated myself, didn't I? Well, we do want to thank a new $5 a month donor.
That would be Sean from Copiag, New York.
Thank you, Sean, and thanks to all of our very generous monthly donors, $2, $5, $10. You guys are really the lifeblood of the show. Also a donation from Tom Robertson in Melbourne, Australia.
I'd like to dedicate my donation to my girlfriend of 9 years, Sarah. All going well, it should in a way recreate when my name got dropped during Massacre Theater in episode number 393, driving to our weekend holiday destination, me in the driver's seat, Sarah in the passenger seat. For 9 years of your love and support and putting up with my many obsessions, including film, I thank you. Happy anniversary, my dear Sarah.
What a nice note there, Tom. Congrats to both Tom and Sarah. I don't know. I'm just going to say 9 years. Tom, I'm going to put you on the spot there a little bit.
No, don't do it.
Don't do it?
No. Move on.
I did date my wife for 8 years, so.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we should just move on. Tom's saying move on right now as they're sitting in the car. And I'll do that. Matthias in Oslo, Norway with another dedication.
I would like to dedicate this donation to my adorable girlfriend, Johanna, who's just discovering film spotting. To Adam, Josh, and Johanna, I hope you'll stay in my life forever.
Oh, we'll stay in your life forever.
We're not going
You're
anywhere.
Not leaving us, Matthias. I hope we're always there with you.
He might want to take it back now.
Your lovely girlfriend. I hope that Adam and Josh are always between you. Another thank you to Samuel Auer from Berlin, Germany.
I just recently discovered your podcast, and I love it. So at the moment, I'm listening to all the old episodes to catch up. In September, I start studying film directing at the Berlin Film Academy, and I honestly hope that one day you will review one of my films. I hope, although it is very little, that my donation will still help. I know the feeling. For all my short films, I was lucky enough that people supported our projects.
You cannot make short films without people volunteering their time, a lot of times their money, certainly their energy, and every little bit does help. Thank you, Sam, and best of luck at film school. And again, thank you to all of our generous donors.
Hi, my name's Steve Coogan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Gentlemen, my lady, you will always remember this as the day that you almost caught Captain Jack Sparrow.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. It's time for the Film Spotting Top 5 this week. It's a mouthful. Top 5 seemed like a bad idea at the time movies. It's a lot to say, but we think it does nicely sum up what we're going for with this list. And you heard there a scene from a very successful movie that I like quite a bit that unfortunately did spawn a bunch of terrible sequels. It's Pirates of the Caribbean with Johnny Depp and Keira Knightley and Orlando Bloom. This is a movie that very well could have made my list if I had known it was based on a theme park ride when I saw it. I'm not a big Disney guy. I didn't know that, but you want to talk about bad ideas. Taking a theme park ride and turning it into a film, but it worked out.
I can't imagine anyone at Disney even thought that was a good idea.
Exactly.
But somehow it got through, and yeah, it did work out. I like that film too.
Yeah, and it goes back to The Amazing Spider-Man. That's what really inspired this list this week. It's a film that unfortunately didn't work out as well as we would have liked, but it is a film, as we noted many times, that is coming right on the heels of the other Spider-Man franchise ending just 5 years ago, and you think, really? Is this a good idea? Do we really need another Spider-Man movie? Mark Webb.
Unlikely director, maybe kind of bland, too.
Yeah.
That's part of it, too, is that
sure.
Choice makes it maybe not a good idea.
So instead of The Amazing Spider-Man movies like that weren't as successful, that were bad ideas and really proved to be bad ideas, these are ones that proved to be something pretty good after all. So how did you form your list?
I have two kinds of movies. That's how I went about it in forming my list. First, these are movies when I first heard about them, they gave me or the movie industry pause. Those were the ones like Pirates of the Caribbean. You've got to be kidding me. The other kind are, I looked back on Hollywood history a little bit and looked at some films that now seem like no-brainers, but initially weren't, to try to mix it up a little bit. So some of these are more personal, some of them are historical.
Interesting. I think we may diverge there a little bit, because I did consider a lot of movies where the subject matter maybe seemed dubious or the film could have gone horribly wrong for a variety of reasons and didn't. That would include movies like Brick, setting a film noir in a high school. Hump Day, if you just take the plot of that film, it shouldn't probably work. The Blair Witch Project sounds kind of like a terrible idea. I think it's a pretty scary film. Black Snake Moan, Hustle and Flow, those Craig Brewer films, really. A film about a black man chaining a white girl to a radiator. A film about a pimp who aspires to be a hip-hop star. Those aren't films that necessarily grab you from that initial plot summary, but turned out to be pretty good. I didn't really consider them for this list, though, because I didn't go into those films with any major reservations. I trusted the filmmakers or just really didn't know any better and went in with an open mind. But there are other ones that I thought about where you get a movie like The Long Goodbye, the Robert Altman film from the 70s that I love. That's a movie that gave the industry pause at the time, because everybody knows that Philip Marlowe is supposed to be Humphrey Bogart.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes and casts Elliot Gould from MASH, this comedic actor. That guy is in no way the hard-boiled private detective audiences would have been used to seeing or want to see. But by the time I saw The Long Goodbye in college, I went in knowing it's a Robert Altman film.
Reputation,
it's
sure.
kind of revered. So I didn't have those reservations watching it. So I tried to think of films where when they came out, when I saw them, they did give me that pause. They did give me that second of thinking, this really seems like a terrible idea. Is it actually going to work?
All right. Well, we might have some differences there. Maybe yours is a little bit personal. But my number five is very personal. And actually, when I heard about this project, it didn't give me pause, but it should have given the industry pause. I was excited about it. It was giving Tim Burton and Michael Keaton Batman. This is a double whammy at the time when you think about it. Let's start with Burton. Nowadays, of course, he's the master of spectacle for good and bad. But consider that before Batman, he was the master of spectacles of a very, very peculiar kind. Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice. This was not necessarily someone to be trusted with such valuable franchise property. Of course, I was already a huge Burton fan at that point, so I was thrilled about it, mostly because it seemed like such a risky choice. Then look at Keaton. What about his lead turn in Beetlejuice suggested Bruce Wayne or Batman? On the surface, really nothing. But Keaton was mostly known as a manic comedian then, and it was that craziness that Burton wanted to tap into. And I think it's what made Keaton's Bruce Wayne, in my mind, the most compelling Bruce Wayne we've had.
You know how people have different sides to their personality?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a person will have to actually lead a different life.
Oh my God, you're married.
No, I'm not married.
That's a great pick. You're right. Not only was Burton a little bit of a surprise to do a big, robust action superhero movie like that, but Michael Keaton was definitely a surprise as well. I'm calling my list the Social Network Memorial List because it is a David Fincher film that I love, and it's also the film that came in the most on Twitter, Facebook, email. Whenever we threw out this topic, a lot of people pointed out it's a Facebook movie. We all said that same thing. I can't believe they're making a movie about Facebook. And of course, as we discussed in detail on the show, the movie is so much more than that. But I think we all had that trepidation about the subject matter, even doubting a brilliant filmmaker like David Fincher. And it turned out. So the Social Network Memorial List here for me. And my number five, Josh, all I have to say is I'm looking at your face and I just want to smash it. I just want to smash it with a sledgehammer and squeeze it. And that movie, of course, would be Punch Drunk Love. And it takes us back to Sarah Pauley's recent film Take This Waltz as well. Remember those two lead characters in that film who, instead of saying cute romantic things, they say mean things to each other about the bad things they want to do to hurt each other?
You're trying to convince me that Take This Waltz is good by comparing it to one of my favorite romantic comedies.
Actually,
okay.
I knew I had seen that dynamic between lovers before, and there you go.
There
actually
is a connection there. I'll give you that.
It came from the Paul Thomas Anderson film, and I went back to look at the reaction when it was said that PTA was going to make a movie with Adam Sandler. And I found this article from Roger Ebert from 2002 where he says, the moment it was announced, I got a lot of emails from people asking what in the hell Anderson was thinking of making an Adam Sandler movie. Such is the power of Sandler's presence that it didn't occur to them it might be a Paul Thomas Anderson movie. Now I have seen it and can report that it is both an Adam Sandler movie by Paul Thomas Anderson. And I know, Josh, that you're a big fan of this film. I feel like it may be heading for your personal penalty box here at some point where you can't mention it for a while. But the only reason why it's my number five is because of the level of doubt I had about it going in. The fact is, Paul Thomas Anderson had made Hard Eight. He'd made Boogie Nights and Magnolia. So it's not like I thought he was going to make an absolute clunker. I did have faith in him. But you hear about a small business owner and abusive sisters and a harmonium. And the small business owner is Adam Sandler, who is coming off the horrible film Little Nicky. And I did wonder if we were finally going to see Paul Thomas Anderson take a fall. And instead, we got a wonderful film with a great performance from Sandler. I think you said during our top five phone calls when a scene from this movie made your list that it was his best performance, which my immediate reaction was, well, duh, there's not a lot to choose from with Adam Sandler. But I really think that Punch Drunk Love was Paul Thomas Anderson's most challenging movie up to that point. It was his least accessible, but certainly far from a step backward. In fact, I think it was a step forward in terms of playing with tone and sound, integrating the harmonium and John Bryan's score, among other really interesting aesthetic choices that he made. So that was one that I was with everyone else scratching my head saying, no, don't do it. Don't make a movie with Adam Sandler. It turned out great.
Yeah,
Punch Drunk Love.
See, the soft spot I had for Sandler, Little Nicky aside, thanks for reminding me of that, actually made me excited for this project.
Okay.
So I totally get that it's on your list, but that's why I couldn't put it on mine. Because when I heard of all these elements, I was buying in. I was ready to go.
Interesting.
I'm going to go historical with number four, and that is letting Dennis Hopper make Easy Rider.
We're rich, man. We're retired in Florida now, mister. You know, Billy, we blew it.
What? That's what it's all about, man. I mean, like, you know. I mean, you go for the big money, man, and then you're free. You dig?
In the late 1960s, it was probably a bad idea to give Dennis Hopper money to make any movie. But one about the road adventures of two drug-smuggling bikers, you can kiss your cash goodbye. But lo and behold, Hopper actually turned in a movie, and it turned out to be a landmark one. In its own laconic way, it's this beautiful capturing of the rhythms of a road trip. But I think, looking back on it now, even though it's thought of as this counterculture piece, this kind of hippie love-in, watching it, you can also detect an acknowledgement there of the alienation and the rootlessness that would become some of the counterculture's costs. There are a lot of levels to this movie.
Absolutely.
Hopper even got a screenplay Oscar nom out of it, so it definitely put him in a different category. Now, was allowing Hopper to make his follow-up, the last movie, a good idea? Not from what I've heard. Have never actually seen it myself. Have you?
I haven't either, no. But Easy Rider is a film I really do love. I think we could take issue with your pick a little bit and debate whether or not it really seemed like a bad idea at the time.
To give him any sort of control, creative control.
I mean, in retrospect, definitely seems like a mistake, even though we got this masterpiece out of it. I think you can call it a masterpiece, but I wonder if at the time he had so much credibility that they thought he could do it.
I can't imagine anyone having him walk into an office and pitch them anything would feel good about signing a check at that time.
No, that's a good point. I think you're right. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five seemed like a bad idea at the time movies. And my number four is a very recent film that I know, Josh, you loved. I think you had it in your top 10 of the year, and it's Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It's a film that I had no intentions of reviewing when it came out. I didn't even have the intention to see it when it came out. It's a case where other critics really compelled me to see it. They really said that, no, it's worth checking out. And it seemed to me from the trailers just another over-CGI'd mindless action movie. We already had one horrible Apes film, a reboot, if you will, from Tim Burton, and the director was Rupert Wyatt, whose name meant nothing to me at the time, and I'd already seen one really good chimp movie from that year, one of my favorite films of the year, the documentary from James Marsh, Project Nim, so I had nothing invested in seeing Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and so I go in and lo and behold find that it's a really smart, really compelling action film that starts out with a gangbusters opening sequence with the chimps being captured and sets up the whole theme of the film. We could spend this entire segment just talking about some of the stupid plot points and some of the bad science that happens in the film, but the fact is that the pace of the film is so fast and the logic holds true from scene to scene with it playing by its own rules that I went with it. I think the action scenes are really well staged, and it's not just about mindless action. It really is about it culminating in a kind of violence as the apes finally do take over and get their revenge. And of course, we've talked a lot on the show over the past year or two about Andy Serkis and all the effects work that went into making his character, the ape Caesar, so impressive. I would have bet you, Josh, $100 that I wouldn't have enjoyed Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and I'm really glad that I didn't make that bet.
It even overcame your chimp movie limit for the year. That's
exactly
impressive. That's quite impressive. Yes, I do love Rise of the Planet of the Apes, an honorable mention for me.
Well, I'm heading to see my brother Lyle. Huh? I said I'm going to see my brother Lyle in Mount Zion.
Where's that?
Wisconsin.
Oh.
Just across the state line.
Cheddarheads.
Aren't those the dumbest things you ever seen somebody stick on their head?
I hear that's a real party place, Wisconsin.
My number three is trusting David Lynch with the Strait story. Lynch's G-rated tale of 73-year-old Alvin Strait, played by Richard Farnsworth, follows a man who rides a lawnmower from Iowa to Wisconsin to visit his estranged and ailing brother. Lynch really has an attention to the uniqueness of Alvin's journey in this film. At one point, the camera hovers over the yellow stripes on the road as they slowly pass by, kind of caresses each one. He turns the movie into this metaphor for a different way of living, slowly, surely, proudly, and with purpose. Now, never mind their perverse, often graphic content, but have any of Lynch's other films even remotely evoked something like that?
No.
Not that I can think of.
I mean, there's a certain quaintness to some of the dialogue, and he loves the music from the 50s, and there's that old-fashioned sense, the old-timey sense of David Lynch, but you're
that,
right.
That could be a small link.
So blocked out by all the other craziness.
Yes. Yes. So hearing that the subversive Lynch was making this, it sounded like a joke at best and a terrible idea at worst. but Lynch made it. It's probably, maybe in a lot of ways, his most subversive film, at least coming from him, making a film that's simple and sweet.
I agree. It is a fantastic choice for this list and a good movie. I think maybe for me, it was another case where I was going to give Lynch the benefit of the doubt because I'm such a fan of his work and was then. But you're right. I remember having that head slap reaction to hearing that David Lynch was going to make that straight story. It just didn't seem to add up. My number three is the movie from Curtis Hanson, 8 Mile, starring Eminem. And I was thinking about this list and why we go in with preconceived notions about a film and why we're automatically against it. And in this case, it's not a matter of the plot sounding silly or weird or whatever the case may be, or is it a matter of the director being someone who didn't seem right for the material? Sometimes it's just what you think about the broad subject matter. Just like with The Social Network, you think, I don't need to see a Facebook movie. Well, when I heard 8 Mile was coming out, I didn't need to see an Eminem movie. I didn't need to see a movie about his life. It's going on right now. I can watch his life in music videos. I can hear it in his music. I can read stories online or in magazines. There was no perspective on Eminem or really any need for perspective on Eminem at the time. And then you have to ask whether you really need to see Eminem act. And do you need to see the guy who made the great L.A. Confidential waste his time directing someone who probably can't act like Eminem? And then you watch the movie and you see that he can act, and Curtis Hanson actually managed to imbue the film and the setting, 1995 Detroit, with a real sense of the conflicts specific to that city, what it was like for that character to grow up there. And the music is fantastic. And what I've always said about the movie 8 Mile on this show, I love the fact that in the end, without really ruining anything, it's not a huge tale of a rise to stardom or redemption. It's really just a small story about a character accepting personal responsibility and taking responsibility for his own actions. And I love the fact that Chris Hansen was willing to make that kind of subtle story about this character. And I was really shocked by how good 8 Mile was.
This guy ain't no motherfucking MC. I know everything he's about to say against me. I am white. I am a punk. I do live in a trailer with my mom. My boy Future is an Uncle Tom. I do got a dumb friend named Cheddar Bob who shoots himself in his leg with his own gun. I did get jumped by all six of you chumps. And wait, this my girl. I'm still standing here screaming the free world.
8 Mile is an honorable mention for me. Didn't put on the list probably for different reasons than you, though, and it actually was Hanson. I was interested in an Eminem story, actually. He's just such a fascinating figure to me, so I was open to that. But I'm not as high on Hanson as a lot of people are. I would consider him more serviceable. And so being kind of interested, excited about the project, then seeing his name on it, I thought, but it did turn out to be a very, very good film. For my number two, listener Tim Klobuchar and I were on the same page. He mentioned casting John Wayne in 1939 Stagecoach, and I'll quote what he said on Twitter about it. Director John Ford had to fight to get him in because he'd been making only B-Westerns for a decade. Only other big starring role was in The Big Trail, which flopped in 1930. In Stagecoach, Wayne makes his entrance about 19 minutes in. He's not the lead star in this, at least not at first. But when he makes his entrance, he enters like a full-blown star. And this is thanks a lot to Ford, who zooms in on him while he's astride a horse, twirling a shotgun, and the screen goes into soft focus. Wayne plays Ringo Kidd, a fugitive who joins a stagecoach that's traveling through Apache territory as Geronimo is on the warpath. What's astonishing about this movie, when you look at it again, is that Wayne is instantly iconic. He's John Wayne, hardly acting at all, which he didn't really bother to do in the movies that I've seen of his. Instead, he relies on his own dominant personality, right down to the unmistakable pattern of speech. And I don't know how to describe it. It's kind of like a stiff drawl, which I realize is an oxymoron, but somehow it works for Wayne, and it works in this movie.
Well, it looks like you've got another passenger.
Yeah. I'll take the Winchester.
You may need me in this Winchester, Curly. Saw a ranch house burning last night.
You don't understand, kid. You're under arrest.
Curly?
Stagecoach, of course, went on to be a huge financial success, launching Wayne's real career. It's now considered one of the definitive American Westerns, and some people say one of the great films of all time.
It really is a classic, the John Ford movie. And you're right, I wouldn't have thought of it for this list because I came to it with the lens of John Wayne,
sure,
great Western hero. But you're right, at the time, it was definitely a step up for him in a film where he really established himself. It's a great pick, and actually, we haven't heard the last of John Wayne here in this segment. My number two is one already on your list, and I'm hoping it's our only overlap. It is Tim Burton's Batman from 1989. And you're right, as you talked, I realized that the real surprise here was probably Tim Burton taking on this action movie, the guy who'd made Pee-wee's Big Adventure and then made Beetlejuice, as you noted, but I didn't know enough about Tim Burton at the time. I had seen those films, but I had no perspective on who the director was. I did have a lot of perspective on Michael Keaton.
Uh-huh.
So this is another case like my number five pick with Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love, where I remember just really being shocked by that casting choice because, for me, I loved Michael Keaton. He was Mr. Mom. He was Johnny Dangerously. So that comic actor being cast to play the Caped Crusader, that just didn't make any sense. He was Beetlejuice, and he wasn't just a comic actor. There's no way Michael Keaton's taller than 5'10". There's nothing physically imposing about him. And if you think about Clark Kent in Superman, Christopher Reeve, yeah, he played the nerdy Clark Kent, but he still filled out the cape. He filled out those tights. He looked the part. I could not see Michael Keaton as a hero or any kind of intimidating presence. But of course, not only does the suit and the mask do most of the work, Keaton actually did have always a little bit of a dark edge to him. And there was something perfect in retrospect about seeing Batman as this non-hero pretending to be a hero. Remember, he's the guy who doesn't have any natural powers. It's the suit, it's his money, his smarts, his obsession. That's what defines him. He's not a character who was born to play that role. So actually, Michael Keaton was really perfect for it, and he was perfect. He'll always be the perfect Batman, I think.
That was really an uproar over that casting, wasn't it, when you think about it? Was it? I wonder if it was the first. I mean, now there's all this angst over every casting decision for every superhero movie that comes out, which is weekly. But it seems like that may have been the first one where people were just entirely up in arms. Like, what are you doing with this beloved figure? But yeah, it did work. All right. Number one, I'm going with Ratatouille. Imagine the pitch at any other studio besides Pixar. Okay. A rat chef who... I'll stop you right there.
Exactly. A rat in the kitchen.
It's, you know, we got to rework that. We'll put some writers on that. But at Pixar, of course, they were open to the story of Remy, French rat who gets a chance to pursue his dreams of being a chef at a legendary Parisian restaurant. And we're all the better for it. Now, it's not just the rat angle, which is considerable, getting over that as the central plot point. But really, this is a children's film about cooking. I mean, that's kind of another hurdle.
And about art?
About
how
art,
you appreciate
yes,
art.
Exactly. But that's the point. This is really a movie. It's a movie for foodies first. The animation makes your mouth water. And it's for anyone who has a passion for creativity, for pushing boundaries. These are the things that Ratatouille really explores. So that kids devour the picture too is, as usual with Pixar, a nice bonus.
I think that's a fantastic choice. You're right. It's a movie I don't think I probably love as much as you do, though I really respect what Brad Bird was up to visually with that movie. I think it's just a wonder. I think I still had too much trouble, honestly, not getting over the gross out factor, but just not seeing Remy and the character whose name I don't even remember that he sort of takes over as a compelling hero. I had a hard time really getting into the fact that he's just really a puppeteer, and I found the puppet really boring. So,
yeah, I'll give you that. I think it's Linguini.
Yeah,
it might be Linguini.
I think it
is that okay? I'll give you that he's kind of bland, but this is Remy's story.
Exactly.
I was so caught. He's just a function
Patton
for
Oswalt,
Remy.
So, the voice,
yes,
right?
One
really
of Pixar's
good.
Best voice performances.
All right. Well, my number one seemed like a bad idea at the time movie is one that's a little bit hard to explain because I considered myself a reasonably enlightened, decidedly non-homophobic guy back in 2005, as I still do. But the first time I saw the trailer for Brokeback Mountain in a theater, surrounded by people, I remember there being a palpable sense of awkwardness. It was as if we all became hyper-aware of ourselves and our surroundings, and we were all thinking the same thing at the same time. Are you seeing what I'm seeing? Those are gay cowboys.
You have no idea how bad it gets. I'm not you. I can't make it on a couple of high altitude f***s once or twice a year. You are too much for me, Asp. You son of a horse and a bitch. I wish I knew how to quit you.
You can't get any more stereotypically rugged and masculine than those old Western heroes like John Wayne, like Clint Eastwood, and seeing Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger, two pretty masculine dudes themselves, saying, I can't quit you. and one of them hugging a coat that belonged to the other, which you see in the trailer. These are things you're so used to hearing and seeing in a traditional heterosexual romantic comedy. And it was pretty shocking at the time. And I think partly because it was playing it, for lack of a better word, so straight. It wasn't as if the film was going out of its way to be shocking based on the trailer or be subversive. It wasn't winking at us in any way. It was just two cowboys in love. And I don't know that I ever really thought it would be a bad movie, but I certainly thought it might not work and that audience was really struggle embracing it. But not only was it not a bad movie, it turned out to be a pretty great one. I'm a big, big fan of that film that does really shatter the romance of the Old West. And you've got the great Rodrigo Prieto cinematography, the Gustav Santaolalla score. There's so much about this movie that works. But I do remember those first one or two times I saw it in a movie theater, and everyone was a little bit surprised that we were actually going to be seeing a gay cowboy movie. But it works.
I think that's the bad idea part of it, is how are we going to find a mainstream audience for this, which is what they were going for. Mm-hmm. And they did end up finding. I guess for me, I was already on board with Ang Lee and was willing to see, okay, whatever he's going to do is going to be interesting. So let's see what he does with this. There's also something interesting with Brokeback Mountain. The studio, and I don't even remember if it was Focus Features, I possibly got ahead of a lot of this somehow, in terms of the word got out very early that this is something really special, and it's handled in a very interesting way. So it was almost like they beat the snickering to the punch a little bit.
Maybe
at least,
so, but
at least when I remember how
there was
becoming aware of it.
There was snickering for me in the theater.
Oh, sure.
I had no idea what was coming. I hadn't heard the Focus Features marketing pitch or heard any of the initial buzz about this film. I was just in a theater watching your normal trailer, and then the gay cowboy trailer comes on, and it's surprising.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
And yeah, no, it makes sense to be on this list,
for sure. It turned out to be a pretty great film, as we said. What about honorable mentions? Any ones for you that you strongly consider, Josh?
Well, The Social Network came up so often, as you mentioned, but here's why I didn't consider it for this list. The idea didn't seem that ludicrous to me, because if you remember that early trailer, it had a cover of Creep on the early trailer, and I thought, okay, they're going to make this an exploration of sort of digital narcissism of our age. Now, that didn't really happen, so I don't hold The Social Network in as high of regard as most people. I like
You're
it.
You're putting too much of a focus on that
good
song
film.
Choice, probably.
Maybe I was. Maybe I bit in on that. But I wanted to see that movie. I wanted to see a movie that used Facebook to explore this burgeoning social media narcissism. And instead, it turned out to be a really interesting character study, is what I found it to be.
Oh, so it's much more than that, but we don't have time.
We'll save that for another time. But anyways, that's why it's just an honorable mention for me. Others we mentioned, Pirates of the Caribbean, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I'd throw 28 Weeks Later in with that group. And then my friend Wendy Fox Weber reminded me that I actually found Guy Ritchie's Swept Away remake, starring then-wife Madonna, oddly entertaining.
Don't do it. Don't say it,
Josh. And not near the disaster it was predicted or has been considered. Now, I am not saying it's a great film.
I can't argue with you. I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen it?
No.
Well, it's fascinating to watch. It's this really bizarre Ritchie family home movie that's very revealing. Now,
you're
that's different from
me.
What I expected. Does that make it great? No.
Well, I'll just mention three honorable mentions. Before Sunset is a movie that I didn't really have any major doubts about because it was Linklater, but I think you could look back on that and think, I loved Before Sunrise so much, I kind of like the fact that they left it open-ended. I don't really need them to go back and tell me what happened to Celine and Jesse. And yet they did, and I might like that movie even better than Before Sunrise. The Matrix, that's a movie I just remember seeing a preview, and it looked like it was trying to be a little bit heady, a little bit smart. And yet you had Keanu Reeves in it, and that just didn't work for me. But, of course, the movie did. And then, finally, I'll just mention 21 Jump Street again. It's a movie that came out this year, disappointed in the last 20 minutes or so, but a really, really funny movie that, like Rise of the Planet of the Apes, when I heard they were making 21 Jump Street into a film, absolutely zero interest. And then you go and find that, kind of like with what we wanted to happen in the Spider-Man movie with Mark Webb, they actually found a way to make 21 Jump Street relevant to this modern time. They actually did reboot that franchise a little bit, though I don't know if we'll ever see more films, but they did breathe new life into it, and I was blown away by how well they pulled that off.
Yeah, I have finally caught up with it, and I would say it is a perfect fit for this list. Very enjoyable.
All right, those are our top five seemed like a bad idea at the time movies. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and @facebook.com/filmspotting.
out wide this weekend, a movie I will be forced to take my family to. They love the Ice Age franchise, all three of my kids who are old enough to appreciate it. So we're going to see Ice Age Continental Drift.
They've just grown up with Ice Age.
They have.
We'll continue to do so.
They have indeed. In limited release, for the third week in a row, I'm going to mention Sarah Polley's Take This Waltz. It seems like it keeps getting pushed back a week.
Oh, they bumped it again?
Apparently now it's just opening in Chicago in theaters this weekend, but as I've mentioned, it's been out on demand for a while and maybe still available. Neil Young Journeys, this is the third collaboration between Jonathan Demme and Neil Young. I've missed all of them and feel really badly about it. I hope to catch up with this one. And Magic of Belle Isle, this is a new movie from Rob Reiner starring Morgan Freeman. On demand, there's a new film called Ball Player, Pelotero. It's about two baseball prospects in the Dominican Republic. That sounds intriguing, but another one that stood out to me that's available now on demand. And Josh, it's amazing what you learn when you're preparing for the show. I'd heard about this film coming out, Trishna. I had no idea that it was adapted from Thomas Hardy's Tessa the D'Urbervilles, and I did know that it was Michael Winterbottom's new film.
First time hearing of it.
There you go. So now all of a sudden, I'm way more interested in this film because I am a fan of Winterbottom's work. So those two films available on demand now. Next week on the show, we didn't cover this during the show, but we were going to talk about Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Right.
We have a really good reason. If you're out there saying, hey, you guys lied to me, I wanted to hear you talk about it. We have a really good reason. It turns out we're going to have a smackdown next week on the show. We've actually got Michael Phillips and A.O. Scott from the New York Times committed to appear on Film Spotting. A.O. Scott's first ever appearance on the show. We're going to talk about Beasts of the Southern Wild, debate that film in style, and also talk about The Dark Knight Rises. The top five, a little bit up in the air. We think we're going to go back to the concept we had initially for this week with Beasts of the Southern Wild, stormy weather movies, movies where weather or violent storms play a key role. But if you've got other good tie-ins, please share them. Feedback at filmspotting.net.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist was Young Jesus. Learn more, conveniently enough, at whoisyoungjesus.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.